Brittany Luce, and welcome back to Sampler, the show where we play you handpicked moments from podcasts you just have to hear. This week is all about food, why we love it, what it means to us, and how our ideas about it are shaped by the world around us. I should note, though, this conversation is definitely going to be meaty. Get it? Meaty. Some of the language in this episode may not be suitable for younger ears. So if you've got any kids around, feel free to press pause and rejoin us later, possibly while eating your favorite snack. With that out of the way, let's get started. So in the studio today with me is somebody who I greatly admire, who I'm so excited is on the show today, Frances Lamb, who is a food writer, editor at large of Clarkson Potter, which is the lifestyle imprint within Penguin Random House, also a judge on Top Chef Masters, and a columnist for New York Times Magazine. Like, who are you even?
I am more than those things, Brittany, but thank you so much.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So we wanted to have Frances on Sampler today because basically I'm absolutely crazy about food. And pretty much since the inception of the show, I was like, so we have to figure out a way to do a food episode, like obviously. And
you can't talk about food for more than 5 minutes while people are being bored.
You think so? Because we're going to disprove that.
I live my whole life on the premise that that isn't true, but I'm a little bit afraid it is. So yeah.
Well, hopefully we can put that to bed. I think we can. I'm feeling really good. I'm excited about the clips we have for you.
Let's try.
So I'm a super huge fan of yours and a lot of your writing. You were a contributing editor for Gourmet magazine before it shut down.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. So that means you know Ruth Reichel.
I do. Ruth is my homegirl.
Damn. That's so crazy to me. I'm sorry. I'm freaking out right now. I'm so excited. Guys, for those of you who don't know, Ruth Reichel is the last editor-in-chief of Gourmet magazine. She is the reason that I learned to cook meat and don't just eat black beans every day.
You know, she is, I totally understand where you're coming from. I was exactly that same way. Uh-huh. In fact, before I started writing for her for the magazine, mm-hmm. I met her. I was a very young, new food writer. I had, I think, literally 6 pieces I had written to my name.
Wow.
And I was at a conference. I saw that she was one of the speakers, and I went up to her. And I was like, hi. I just wanted to say hello. And so it was painfully awkward. And I think, just to be gracious, she looked down at my, name badge, uh-huh. You know, and said, contributing writer, Financial Times. And, literally, I'd written, 6 pieces for them. And so, it was really only barely true that I got this, title. And she looks down and goes, oh, the FT. Well, they don't print junk. And I made some stupid joke about, I tricked them. Word to the wise, when you're meeting your heroes, don't make stupid self-deprecating jokes.
Yeah.
Don't be like, hey, you should know me because I'm awesome. But don't be like, yeah, my shit's junk. But she, again, super graciously said, oh, okay, well, you know, why don't you, I would love to see what you've done. Why don't you send me some of your pieces?
That's
and I was
so
like,
kind.
Awa, 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 awa. So that's how I met Ruth Reichel.
Oh my God.
And that's how I started writing for the magazine.
So you went to University of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
You went to Culinary Institute. Started writing. You kind of entered the game at this point where food culture kind of emerged and changed. So the first clip we're going to play for you today is going to, I guess, start with the state of the world of food presently. So it's Alton Brown on the Eater Upsell podcast. He's telling hosts Greg Morabito and Helen Rosner how food culture has changed since he started working at Food Network in 1999.
We've all become aware, we're hyper aware. I can say that we're all very, very aware because we're absorbing and consuming food media. But the real game changer, when you get right down to it, for better or worse, was Starbucks. Because Starbucks is everywhere, and now we all accept paying $4 for a coffee. Everyone does now. So what happened is then, of course, anywhere that Starbucks was, you eventually got third wave coffee. So now we've got funky pour over coffee shops, you know, so we're all starting to become very sophisticated in our palates, you know, and so we're starting to value things. You know, you can look at Starbucks, whether you like it or not, and then Whole Foods as being something that really in, 1999 wouldn't have existed at the level that it does now. So we're all extraordinarily aware. We're willing to spend money on quality. What's funny though, is I think that we're more sophisticated as eaters than cooks. You know, I know people that can detect the difference between whether we've made the bouillabaisse with you know, Turkish saffron or Iranian saffron, but couldn't cook the seafood in the bouillabaisse if you held a gun to their head, you know. So we've become far more sophisticated as consumers.
That seems like a logical parallel to the way that food has evolved as part of our culture. Because, you know, I think it's not infrequent that food is analogized to the rise of music in the 70s and 80s. Music saturation of America was not the creation of music, it was the consumption of music. And that seems like the route to popular culture. You become a thing for people to purchase and identify themselves around and know things about rather than become experts in the creation of.
Well, it's interesting that you would mention, you know, consumption, because that has a lot to do also with changing business models. You know, people talk a lot about the touring year of 1973, when Led Zeppelin, The Who, and Alice Cooper all went out on these massive arena tours that changed the way the business of rock and roll was done. And I think that what we've done is we've gotten ourselves into a place where we've changed the way that the food business is done, very, very much so. And so I think it's a good analogy. We are consuming at that level. The only real difference is that not everybody has to consume music. Everybody does have to consume food.
There was a really fascinating interview with you in the New York Times. The interviewer was asking you about people loving food, and you said that everybody loves food and people try to convince you that they should be on Next Food Network Star, or they should be getting whatever job because they love food.
Because they love it so much.
And you said this great line, which was, at best, love is the gasoline, it's not the car.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't have the passion, you're probably not going to get anywhere, but the passion in and of itself is not terribly interesting. And yeah, we do see that all the time, certainly.
I feel like everyone loves food now, and I don't know if that was the same as 20 years ago.
I think people just didn't think, you know, there was a time when people simply were thinking about how to get enough of it, you know, or having to get it on the table. My grandmother, my late grandmother, who I adored, never could get her head around the idea of Food Network. She's like, I got to get up at, you know, 6 o'clock every morning and make breakfast for Bob. Why the hell would I want to watch that on television? Because it was a thing you did. It was a chore. It's like chopping wood or anything else. It wasn't celebrated. It wasn't like, oh my gosh, this apple butter is artisanal. It was like, it's food.
So you've been in the mix for a long time. Have you seen like a similar arc? Have you seen a similar sea change?
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like my career is obviously a product of that sort of shift in our culture. What we're talking about in terms of like the rise of food media mm-hmm. and sort of the popularization of food media mm-hmm. obviously can't be divorced from just how media has changed and how we discover new voices has changed. The very first story I had published was for the Financial Times. Mm-hmm. It came about because I was a student in culinary school in 2002. And I was like 25 when I was in cooking school. And I was over the I'm too cool for school thing. Like, here I am paying tuition dollars to be in a classroom. Like, I'm going to make it count, yeah. right? So I like was in front of every class, taking notes, asking the chef questions, stopping the demo every 5 seconds. Chef, why this, why this, why this? And then going home and just writing these long emails to friends and family about what I learned that day mm-hmm. or stories. And, oh my God, did you know there are only three ways to fillet a fish? And if you learn the three ways of filleting a fish, you can fillet any fish in the goddamn ocean. Like, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And then on that same day, I was walking home from school like 10 o'clock at night, and some guy comes out of his class and goes, hey, I just learned to fry donuts. Opens a box.
What?
Want one? You know, like, where am I? This place is unreal. So I'm like writing these emails to friends and family, telling them about this insane life I'm living now. And I got a phone call. Mm-hmm. An editor from the Financial Times said, hey, a friend of yours has been forwarding these emails to me. They're a lot of fun. Would you want to write something for us about what it's like being a culinary school
student? So someone
student.
Just found you, which is like not, yeah. It's like weird because like now, I guess it's like easier to get discovered because you can like just put something on the internet and someone could literally actually physically find it. But there's so many people that are making right. things that it's right. like, how do you even stick out at this point? People are so used to like consuming content that way.
Exactly. But like specific to like our culture, you could never get anyone to publish a story now, but like, oh my God, what's it like being a culinary school student? Now, all mm-hmm. people do is obsess about food. Now there's talk of like all the way like to the other extreme where like, oh, people don't love like music anymore. They don't go to shows anymore. All they want to do is go to restaurants and Snapchat yeah. it, you know? And food has come so far in terms of its centrality in our pop culture that it's super dizzying. And I just feel incredibly fortunate to have been there
right when that wave was about to hit.
Inherent in what you and Alton Brown are saying is this idea that people are now spending more and more of their money on food, mm-hmm. you know, whereas people used to save up because they wanted to see their favorite band. Now they'll save up. I mean, I do this too. Now they save up to go to a restaurant that they've always wanted to go to that maybe is like a little bit more expensive than like your average night out, as opposed to like dining being something that you do before you do the thing. Now dining is the thing. I really want to talk about this concept, you know, like what makes a food expensive. And that brings me to our next clip. So WNYC's food podcast, The Sporkful, did a 5-part series called Other People's Food. So as a part of the series, the host, Dan Pashman, explores the concept of poor people's food and how we make judgments about the value of some cuisines over others.
Most Americans would hesitate to pay $30 for Chinese food, but they wouldn't bat an eyelid to pay hundreds of dollars. Sometimes over the last couple of years, the most expensive New York City restaurants have been Japanese restaurants.
This is Professor Krishnendu Ray, chair of the Food Studies Department at NYU. He says there's a reason why we're willing to pay so much more for some cultures' foods than others, and it's actually not about the food at all.
Most of the Japanese we are familiar with are our business folks, our executives. But right now, most Americans associate Chinese food with relatively impoverished Chinese immigrants. If a group of people are doing well and if a country is doing well economically, we tend to upgrade our estimation of their culture. And that feeds back into whether we consider it cheap ethnic food or we consider it expensive foreign food.
This idea that some foods are perceived as higher class than others, Professor Ray calls this the hierarchy of taste. He says over time, it changes.
Give it 20 more years, Chinese immigration is going to slow down like it happened with European immigration. And once that happens, we don't meet relatively poor and impoverished Chinese here. Our valuation of Chinese food is going to change in terms of class terms. That happened with Italian food. That Italian food, in fact, became prestigious only after Italian immigration effectively stopped of poor people.
Okay? And correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, generations ago, Italian people were made fun of for smelling like garlic.
Exactly.
And their food was considered low class.
Yeah, nutritionists and public health specialists were full of disdain for Italian food as not good for us because they were eating all this spicy food in those days. This was considered, especially garlic. And the argument was that all this garlic led to craving for alcohol. And what I like about American culture is, in fact, the possibility of breaking through it, which I think makes American food very interesting and much more open-minded than many of the nationalist cuisines of other parts of the world.
Love that guy. You know, I think what Professor Ray is talking about there in terms of valuing someone's food being akin to how you value that person's culture and by extension, valuing that person.
Yeah.
It's a really, really complicated issue. And almost no one is aware of it and thinks of it in those terms, right?
Yeah.
And I edited a cookbook, came out last fall, called Tacos, Recipes and Provocations by Alex Tupac and Jordana Rothman. Mm-hmm. And Alex is an amazing chef. He's got a really super interesting story of his own, is how he came to Mexican food. He's not Mexican, did not grow up with it. Mm-hmm. As he puts it, literally in the first two sentences of the book, I'm a white boy from Massachusetts, but he has a restaurant inspired by Mexico. And he was serving a taco that was a taco of seared scallops, caper raisin emulsion, caramelized cauliflower.
Sounds so good.
Sounds good as hell, right?
Yeah.
Everyone complained about it. What do you mean this taco cost $12? Like, are you kidding me? This taco cost $12. This is bullshit. You can't charge that much for a taco. Uh-huh. That taco was called Scallops JGV. That was the name of the taco. Mm-hmm. JGV is Jean-Georges Van Lierichten,
yeah,
who is a 4-star chef. He has his, you know, flagship restaurant is 4-star restaurant Jean-Georges in Midtown Manhattan. He has served a dish of seared scallops, caramelized cauliflower, and caper raisin emulsion as one of the signature dishes of that restaurant since like 1996 mm-hmm. or something like that. Alex called Jean-Georges up and said, hey, I would love to serve your dish in my restaurant. Can I use your recipe and put your name on it? Jean-Georges said, yes, sent him the recipe. That's the same dish. Now, Alex is saying, okay, you would never bat an eyelash going to Jean-Georges mm-hmm. and paying $40 for that dish.
Yeah.
you come to Empeyon, you get that dish on a tortilla. Literally, I am adding more food to that dish.
Yeah.
It's $12, and all of a sudden, that's goddamn too expensive. It needs to be cheap. So what does that say about how you value Mexican cuisine and how you value other cuisines? What does that say about how you value Mexican culture? What does that say about how you value the Mexican people? Mm-hmm. If you're literally getting the same thing, but because now it's quote-unquote Mexican, it's got to be cheap.
No, right, totally. And we're going to get more into the politics of food after the break. But first, to recap what we've heard so far, the Alton Brown clip came from the Eater Upsell podcast, and the explanation of why we value some foods over others was from The Sporkful. Sampler will be back with more tasty tidbits in just a minute. Get it? Tasty. So we are back with Frances Lam. No shade to the rest of your resume. Most recently famous to me as the editor of Chrissy Teigen's cookbook, Cravings.
I'll take it.
You'll take it. For those of you who don't know and don't have an internet, don't have like eyeballs
don't
or
have
like
the internet.
Yeah, don't
Here's
have
who Chrissy Teigen.
Yeah, Chrissy Teigen is like a swimsuit model. She's also married to Grammy-winning R&B star John Legend. She's also an amazing home cook, and she wrote this cookbook, Cravings. So over the course of like Cravings coming together, which I could witness via Chrissy's Instagram, I became really invested in Adina Sussman, the recipe writer who co-wrote the book.
She's like, awesome.
Yeah, I didn't Adina's even know, awesome. Like, I didn't even really understand the concept of a recipe writer as a job. It was really cool to learn that this is like its own kind of discipline. What makes a good recipe writer and like a not so great recipe writer?
It's knowing who your audience is. It's recognizing, hey, I'm writing this for a home cook who is really primarily interested in being able to make dinner for his family in, you know, a limited amount of time mm-hmm. on a Thursday night. Or knowing, okay, no, this is a recipe for a woman who is really going to entertain and has, you know, 7 hours to spare to make yeah. this dish, you know? And when you can get yourself into the headspace of that person, how well can you communicate to them? Cook it at high heat for 7 minutes? Okay, what do you mean when you say cook it high for 7 minutes? Your stove and my stove are not the same. Your yeah. pans and my pans are not the same. Does 7 minutes mean I want it like dark coffee brown? Does 7 minutes mean the onions are starting to get translucent? Mm-hmm. I think a really beautiful recipe writer can use evocative language mm-hmm. to put that image in your brain so you know what you're looking, seeing, smelling, listening for, and like touching for. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, do you want to be a very highly technical recipe writer who's really super obsessed with accuracy for the most common use case, right? So they will mm-hmm. test a recipe like 19 different ways from Sunday.
Like just test them for foolproofness, sort of like the way that I've written this. Can, like, is this something
can
that you can do?
Anyone screw this up?
Yeah.
To me, it's not about, like, oh, what is a good versus not good recipe writer? It's what is that recipe writer's style? Mm-hmm. What are they trying to do? And who are they trying to write for? Mm. So Chrissy's book, it was, like, one of the easiest books to edit in terms of the recipes because Chrissy and Adina were so straightforward and so clear as to what they wanted. Mm-hmm. And they wanted the food to be very accessible, very approachable because that's how Chrissy cooks on her own,
yeah.
you know?
There's an entire chapter in this book, and it's like it divided up in all these different things, starches and carbs, salads if you need them, supper. But there's this whole section called Thai Mom. And like that chapter like takes someone's cuisine from their origin country, something that's like really personal to them, and like managed to translate it, which is a term that I don't even really like necessarily using, but managed to sort of like simplify it without dumbing it down and to make it approachable to somebody who may have found the ingredients or the techniques like unfamiliar, but still maintaining the integrity of like what it is that that person eats. So Chrissy is a self-proclaimed home cook, and she was criticized even before the book came out just for not being a chef. And, you know, for writing a cookbook. And, you know, I really loved the Thai Mom chapter because it was like Chrissy kind of like, you know, she may not be a chef. She may not be classically trained. But by growing up around Thai food and by being Thai and having a Thai mom, she's like inherently an authority on the cuisine in a way that somebody who's trained in it but might not share that same background can't be.
So our next clip is actually about that. It comes from a different episode of the WNYC Sporkful series, Other People's Food. The series, honestly, it was just so good that we couldn't pick only one clip. This one is something that sort of like stopped me cold a little bit when I heard it. In this episode, host Dan Pashman is interviewing Rick Bayless. If you haven't been to one of his numerous Mexican restaurants in Chicago, even I've eaten at a Frontera Grill in the O'Hare Airport, you probably know Bayless. Yeah, it's actually really good. Yeah, it's really good. You probably know Bayless from his long-running PBS show, Mexico One Plate at a Time. So he, like, loves Mexican food, but he's been criticized by some for being a white guy who makes Mexican food. So in this clip, Pashman addresses the issue with him.
For Bayless's part, he sees his work as just the way foods move around the world.
You ask most Mexicans about mole, which is the most revered dish in the Mexican repertoire. And they'll say, oh, it dates back millennia. It came from the pre-Columbian cultures. And then I always want to ask next, then why are 50% of the ingredients in a mole from elsewhere in the world? It just doesn't make sense. You talk about a red chili sauce, yeah, you could say that goes back for millennia. But mole is actually a fusion dish that has elements from Southeast Asia and elements from Europe blended together seamlessly with ingredients from the New World.
And so when you look at things that way, I can see how you taking Mexican food and bringing it to the U.S. and in some ways adapting it to help translate it, to use your word, to a white American audience is in keeping with the same traditions that created Mexican food in the first place. It doesn't seem like such a crazy departure, but as much as I know that there are many grandmothers who love you like their own grandsons because of your work and your cookbooks, there are also other Mexicans and Mexican Americans who are like, screw this guy Rick Bayless. And so how do you feel when you get that kind of reaction to your work?
Well, usually people that have that opinion of me don't want to have a conversation. Those people that say it are usually very political, and they have a mouthpiece, and they just go around saying it, and everybody thinks, oh, lots of people must believe that. And honestly, I don't think they do. I know that there have been a number of people out there that have criticized me only because of my race. Because I'm white, I can't do anything with Mexican food. Okay, so you have to stop and say, wait, is that just plain racism then?
So what is it that you think that they don't understand? Like, what's the conversation you want to have with them? What would you like to say to them?
I would just like to talk to them about Mexican food, and I would talk. And I think that within 10 minutes into a conversation, I could share my passion for promoting what I think is the greatest cuisine on the planet, and that it doesn't come from a shallow understanding of it. It comes from a very deep understanding of it. I've done everything that I could to make it my own, and I just don't even understand where they're coming from. It just sounds like sort of weird racism.
Do you think that at times in your career it has been to your advantage to be white?
I don't know the answer to that. I certainly have never thought about that. I mean... The fact that I could talk to people in a certain way, maybe that has been an advantage of mine. But still, I had to craft the words. It wasn't just because I was white that they would come to my restaurant, because restaurants fail at alarming rates. And I think probably all of our listeners know that. And to be a growing restaurant for 30 years... says something that has to do a lot, I think, with the flavor of the food on the plate.
Well, I first want to say I don't really see any valid argument for like who can and who can't make a food. Mm-hmm. So a few years ago, I read this story from the New York Times that was called Cuisines Mastered as Acquired Taste, I think was the headline they gave it. And mm-hmm. It was about this idea of chefs who have become famous for cooking cuisines they didn't grow up in.
and in a lot of ways have become the ambassador for these cuisines, even though there are plenty of immigrants who represent those cuisines in our country. And I talked to a lot of people, including Rick Bayless, mm-hmm. about their experience doing that. In that article, I remember I was talking to Andy Ricker, who is who has restaurants, a number of different restaurants under this name of Pok Pok. Mm-hmm. He is a white guy from Vermont, lives in Portland, Oregon, but has traveled to Thailand for a quarter to a third of every year for the last 20-some-odd years, has learned to cook food there, and his restaurants are, you know, the food that he has discovered in his travels. Mm-hmm. And he was saying, you know, people look at me and say, that's, you know, it's so weird that this white guy's cooking Thai food. I don't know if I can trust it or what's the deal with it or whatever. And it's like, but no one looks at an Irish chef cooking Italian food and being like, whoa, what's up with that? Mm-hmm. You know, there's a great restaurant in New York, Tertulia. It's a Spanish restaurant. And the chef's name is Seamus Mullen. And there aren't that many people ready to be like, yo, Seamus. You can't cook Spanish food. What's up with that?
But do you think that has to do with also, like, there's not like a history of colonization between, like, Irish people and Spanish people? Like,
sure.
Like, the optics, I mean, there's a history of, like, colonization and, like, imperialism with a lot of countries around the world. The optics of that, I feel like, make people uncomfortable. And, like, history in general,
yeah.
Like, it does, to my mind, it does kind of change. You know, it's not exactly necessarily the same scale. Like, an Irish chef cooking Spanish food is not necessarily the same as, like, a white guy from Vermont picking up Thai food.
Sure. And this is what I want to say to that, too. I think I'm super sympathetic to that argument. I'm super sympathetic to the argument that, mm-hmm. like, yo, it is kind of weird and kind of screwy that, like, when Pok Pok opened in New York City, it was instant. Like, people, like, all over, like, the food media, food blogs were like, this is the Thai food game changer for New York City. Finally, New York is getting, like, real serious Thai food. And there are 300 Thai restaurants run by Thai people in New York City.
Yeah.
Not one of them was really worth your time until Andy Ricker showed up.
Yeah.
And Andy would never say that. And Andy's a friend of mine, and I respect him greatly. But, like, I just think the degree to which people launched themselves at his feet when he showed up in New York City was really interesting and instructive to me, and actually inspired me to, like, look into this issue of, okay, why is it that, like, all these quote-unquote immigrant cuisines or quote-unquote ethnic cuisines or whatever you want to call them have, like, white saviors?
Mm.
And so I spoke with Andy, and I spoke with Alex Tupac from MPN,
yeah.
who later, you know, became an author that I work with. And mm-hmm. obviously, I also respect and admire. And Rick Bayless is someone I respect and admire enormously. And Rick said a lot of interesting things. He's a super intelligent and super thoughtful guy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he did say, you know, in some ways, I think I do have an advantage in terms of learning the cuisine, not growing up in it, because I don't have to be wedded to the way my grandmother made something. That doesn't have to be, like, the ultimate version of that dish for me. I can go and find many different versions of a dish that many grandmothers made, and I can pick and choose, like, just based on taste and based on, like, what I'm learning as an outsider. Like, there are ways in which being an outsider gives you a different kind of perspective, and in mm-hmm. some ways a more instructive perspective than being an insider.
No, certainly. I mean, trust me, I did not arrive at this job through traditional means.
Yeah,
so
exactly,
I can understand
exactly,
that.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, he brought that up. I'm like, oh, that's super interesting. That's super valid. But, you know, when I heard that interview that he did with Dan, I was surprised to hear, or I was really interested when he said, wow, I've never really thought about whether or not being white has given me any kind of advantage. And,
yeah.
And his instinct was to say, like, no, I don't think it has, because I still had to put in the work. And then he says, well, maybe if there was one, it's that I can maybe talk to people a certain way. And I think that's the key. One of the things that's really hard to talk about white privilege is, look, I'm not saying you didn't have to put in the work.
Yeah.
Rick Bayless put in the goddamn work, but being a very mediagenic, very sort of mainstream, good-looking white American
mm-hmm.
certainly gave him advantages in terms of the media. The most succinct way I heard someone talk about this idea of white privilege
mm-hmm.
is not that the game is set on easy for you. It's that the game is set on harder for someone else.
Mm.
And actually, someone was telling me, like, a teacher actually was doing this at this exercise in their classroom,
mm-hmm.
and they put the garbage can in the front of the room, told everyone to take a piece of paper, ball it up and throw it in the garbage can.
Yeah.
And everyone who gets it in the garbage can gets a point. But you could, but you had to sit at your desk and do it.
Uh-huh.
So all the kids in the front row made the basket, mm-hmm. and they were like, yeah. And like most of the kids in the second row made the basket, and they were like, yeah. And then all the kids in the back row missed the basket. And they're like, that's kind of what white privilege is like. You didn't choose to be where you're sitting, right?
Yeah.
It's not like you couldn't have the skill to shoot it in from the first, second, third, or fourth row.
Yeah.
Like, you did it. Congratulations. Awesome. It just means that you might not realize it, but the person throwing behind you has a little bit of a tougher time doing it.
Mm.
And you might never have to see it because you were just looking at the basket. And for myself, the same way. Like, I sort of regret talking about that classroom exercise in terms of white privilege, because I'm not white, but I experience plenty of forms of privilege in my life, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not always aware of where my privilege gets in the way of my being able to see where someone else with the same level of intelligence and skill and intentionality might mm-hmm. have a harder time doing what I'm able to do.
Certainly.
So just privilege generally is a hard but important thing for us to keep examining in ourselves.
Well, Francis, you said at the beginning of the interview that you can't talk about food for longer than 5 minutes without people getting bored. Do you feel like we did a good enough job disproving that?
Are you trying to get me to grade the show?
maybe a little bit.
Well, yeah, because we didn't have to talk about food. We have to sit here and talk about, like, oh my God, this pizza and the tomatoes, the acidity of the tomatoes balances so well with the cream and the cheese. Oh my God, and the chew and the, oh my God, and you can really taste how long it was fermented. Oh my God.
I mean, I think we did manage to push beyond that a little bit. Well, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
So I don't know about you guys, but this episode has made me hungry. I might have to go get some tacos after this. But first, let's review our buffet of clips. Today, on our journey through the complicated culinary world, you heard Alton Brown describe our modern food culture on the Eater Upsell podcast, and the clips on expensive versus cheap food and Rick Bayless confronting his privilege both came from The Sporkful. This episode was produced by Rose Reed, Sarah Abdurrahman, and myself, with help from Kate Parkinson Morgan. It was edited by Annie Rose Strasser. Special thanks to Austin Mitchell and Eric Eddings. Our theme music was made by Mike Avellian, and our ad music was made by Mark Phillips. Additional music in the show was made by Bobby Lord. The show was mixed by Matthew Bowl. Sampler is a production of Gimlet Media.